Yes.
TV's on a favorite son. It's watching how the West was won. Daddy, please, a plastic gun. Good brother, one for twice the fun. Little camo helmet heads, making brave and playing dead. Missiles made of gingerbread and dollars on the dime. Hey-ho, so it goes, the point of sale, the puppet show. The merchant kings of war and love return their hands to labor. Sound out the trumpet noise, the cannon spark and jump for joy. Someone's dread darling boy has fallen on his saber. Another world across the sea, home for little busy bees, sweating in some factory. A hurry please, more of these. Action dolls and laser sights, robot blades that shoot at night. Faster kid and get it right. So it goes, the point of sale, the puppet show. The merchant kings of war and woe return their hands to labor. Sound out the trumpet noise, the cannon spark and jump for joy. Someone's dread and darling boy is falling on his seat. Submarines, foreign fiends, and magazines. Wave the flag and watch the news and tell us we can count on you. Cause mom and dad, well, they're marching too. Children step in time. Hey, oh, so it goes. The point of sale, the puppet show. The merchant kings of war and woe return their hands to labor. Sound out the trumpet noise, the cannon spark and jump for joy. Something's dread and darling boy is falling on his saber. Some greenier kids and cuddle pets, balancing babes with bassinets. We'll play a game with tanks and jets, and better yet, bayonets, marching bands. Forget your credit card, Johnny, hold the line. Hey, oh, so it goes, the point of sale, the puppet show. The merchant kings of war and woe return their hands to labor. Sound out the trumpet noise, the cannon spark and jump for joy. Someone's dreading, darling boy, is falling on his saber. Yes, someone's dreading, darling boy, is falling on his saber.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can listen to this program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. Coming up next, Bill McKibben and Chris Mooney talk about the XL Pipeline, Do the Math Tour, the rallying of college students to call for the universities to divest from fossil fuel companies.
I'm Chris Mooney. We have a great show for you today with a great guest, the environmental leader and best-selling author, Bill McKibben. So when we last had Bill McKibben on this program in 2010, I was mainly treating him as, you know, another best-selling science author, one who happens to focus a lot on climate change. Well, something kind of big happened in the intervening years, and Bill McKibben became, simply put, the country's bar none leading environmental spokesman, advocate, and activist. From protests against the Keystone XL pipeline to most recently his Do the Math tour on climate change and his rallying of college students to call for their universities to divest from investments in fossil fuels, McKibben now speaks for a stunning mass movement of concerned people, many of them young, many of them terrified, at what is happening to the planet. The planet that in his last book, McKibben decided needed a different name because the old name just didn't describe it any longer. So we are thrilled to have him back on the show. Bill McKibben, welcome back to Point of Inquiry.
Chris, as always, what a pleasure to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you for the second time on the show. And when we last visited with you, you were talking about your last book, which is awesome. I can never pronounce it right, though. It's Earth, right?
Well, you gotta channel your inner Schwarzenegger a little more. Right. It's, you know, it's Earth, Earth, and it's, you know, the conceit is in the title. It's just right. That we've already changed the planet. The trouble is, you know, I wrote it in 2010. In the 2 years before, we've added at least another A, maybe two. You know, this summer was almost beyond belief watching the Arctic melt. By the time it was over, Jim Hansen, I think, said it best, just said, look, this is what a planetary emergency looks like.
I know, it's incredible just how much weather has changed the complexion of the climate issue just since that time. And since that time, something else has happened. I mean, you had already created 350.org, I think it was in 2008, 2009. But since then, I mean, it's really come on strong. I feel like I'm talking to not just an author, but the leader of a mass movement. I mean, what happened? When did you know that that was happening?
Well, you know, 350 has been a kind of interesting operation. We started it, as you said, in 2008, myself and seven undergraduates with no money or anything. And our first goal was massive worldwide education. It was an absurd, kind of ludicrous goal, but somehow we managed to kind of do it. We've held about 20,000 rallies now in every country on Earth except North Korea. And we've brought the news of climate change to a lot of places where people didn't know about it, including a lot of parts of the U.S. But given the pace of the physical deterioration of the planet, it's been sort of clear that we needed to sharpen that beyond that kind of education into real action. And we probably started that, in a sense, 18 months ago with this fight against the Keystone Pipeline that we sort of spearheaded. It became the largest civil disobedience action in 30 years in this country. And one of those rare, temporary but powerful wins over the fossil fuel industry. We don't know whether the president will keep his moratorium in effect, but for now, though they're building, unfortunately, a kind of southern extension of this thing, they have not been able to put their border crossing across to the tar sands of Canada. And that means there's 900,000 barrels a day of tar sands oil, the dirtiest stuff on the planet that isn't flowing. That was good. It taught us a lot about how to stand up to the fossil fuel industry, but it also taught us that we probably weren't going to win one pipeline, one coal mine, one oil well at a time. It's an incredible amount of work, and there's just too many of them. Hence, the effort now, the kind of third stage of our work here and around the world, to take on the fossil fuel industry as a whole more directly. I wrote a long piece this summer for Rolling Stone, kind of laying out the math of why it is that these guys have become public enemy number one, and we can talk about that. Mm-hmm. The good news is, in the last 6 or 8 weeks, we've managed to translate that analysis into a real movement. I've just come back from this month-long, every single night roadshow that we did across the country, playing to big, sold-out houses, 2,000-3,000 people in every corner of the country. And better yet, it's launched a real movement. As of today, we're closing in on 160 campuses with active divestment movements from fossil fuel. It's the biggest student movement about anything in a couple of decades, and it's just beginning to lift off and mushroom in a powerful way.
Well, all of this is stunning, and actually, you know, you've charted the course of all the things I want to ask you about, so now I have to, like, pick one. But I just want to ask you first, before we talk about the Keystone XL, talk about this divestment campaign that has caught on like wildfire. How do you negotiate the merger of writer and activist? I mean, it's sort of paradoxical. So many writers are sort of like these antisocial characters out of the movie Despicable Me or something like that. You know, but movements need charisma. They need empathy. I mean,
This is the problem.
Yeah,
we really could use a charismatic leader, and that's not me, you know.
Oh, but it is you. It clearly is you, because I mean, this has happened.
I do what I can, and we had this great. What was great about this roadshow we did around the country was it was bringing in all, instead of just being somebody sort of giving a lecture, you know. We had either on tape or in person all kinds of the people that we love to work with all over the world. We had, you know, Naomi Klein was there a lot, and Van Jones on tape every night, and great scientists, you know, Jason Box at Ohio State, the young scientist who's been telling us for the last couple of years what's going on in Greenland. We had Desmond Tutu, you know, who's worked with 350 from the beginning, as one of my great heroes, talking about the parallels between divestment from South Africa and from fossil fuel. Kumi Naidu, who runs Greenpeace International, reflecting on his days as a South African student activist. Winona LaDuke was there a bunch of nights. Reverend Lennox Yearwood, who runs the Hip Hop Caucus. We just had kind of traveling. Josh Fox, who made Gasland, Marty Cobenes from the Indigenous Environmental Network, on and on and on and on. Every night, different folks showing up. That's what movements look like, you know. They're dynamic collections of people who like each other, who work well together, who come from different perspectives but understand how to cooperate, and it's precisely what we've needed for a long time. So I'm not charismatic leader, but it is fun to get to play impresario a little bit and bring together sort of people who really are charismatic and magnificent.
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Can we see by the one light in all our earth to embrace at the call of all nations, where our children can play in a world without war? Where we stand hand in hand in the grace of creation, where the rivers run clean through the forests of green, where the cities stand tall in the clear skies of freedom. Oh, say do our hearts sing out for harmony and love forever on the planet of our birth, blessed with on Earth.
And now back to Bill McKibben and Chris Mooney talking about climate movements.
Well, you might be selling yourself a little short on the charisma, but let me talk about 350.org. We're going to pass 400.org. We're going to pass it in like 2 years. What does that mean?
Well, it means we're in big trouble. 350 is the most important number in the world, but no one even knew about it until 2008. And Jim Hansen, kind of at my request, he and his team calculated what the safe level of carbon in the atmosphere would be. That any value above 350 parts per million is not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. Which you can tell by looking around. I mean, you know, we've taken some of the largest physical features on Earth, say the Arctic, and broken them, you know, and done it in short order. We're already way, way too high. So So stopping global warming, sadly, is no longer one of the options that's on the table. The only question is now, can we keep it from just overwhelming us? Can we keep it from getting absolutely impossible to deal with?
What about President Obama? I mean, can we stop it? It doesn't seem like you're waiting with bated breath for him to take the lead on climate change, but sometimes he sounds like he really wants to take it on, and then other moments he's sort of really blah. I mean, it's like he's hard to decode. What do you make of that?
I can never figure it out. I mean, I think that like most politicians, it's foolish to wait around for them to lead. I mean, we talk about political leaders, but that's kind of a misnomer, I'm afraid, at this point. For the most part, you have to hope that if you can get something going, they'll follow along, you know. We're going to get the real test of whether President Obama has any interest in helping much with this sometime in the course of the new year when he makes the call on the Keystone thing. In this case, he doesn't have to, you know, get John Boehner's permission, and he doesn't have to find any money. And it's just a pure, straight up and down call. Are you going to sign the piece of paper or not? And he set it aside a year ago for more study. So we needed to study more. And in the interim, you know, I would contend that Mother Nature filed her public testimony. We had the warmest year in American history. We had the hottest month ever recorded in American history in July 2012, any month, any year. We had that weird sort of statistically impossible summer in March, you know, when the temperature was 94 degrees in South Dakota 2 days before the end of winter. We had record wildfires in Colorado and New Mexico. They gave into that just epic drought that still is besieging the heartland of the country and turning the Mississippi into a big ditch. We had that rapid melt of the Arctic, and we had a pretty bizarre storm that came up the East Coast late in the hurricane season, the lowest barometric pressure ever recorded north of Cape Hatteras, the largest storm we've ever measured, 1,040 miles across. That's just on our continent, you know. You look around the rest of the world, the same sort of thing going on. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of study the president makes of all that. You know, I think we're going to find out a lot.
It's so strange because, you know, Sandy helped pave his way to reelection. I mean, I really think it made a difference. And yet, when he does his press conference or when Jay Carney does a press conference, they refuse to link it to climate change, even though the science is actually there. I mean, I've written about, if nothing else, Sandy, you know, the sea level rise was higher, so the storm surge was higher because of climate change. It's just, it's very, very simple, that argument, even if all the others are complex. And yet the president is not willing to make the link. It's amazing to me.
Look, the fossil fuel industry is the most powerful industry the world has ever seen. They've got more money. I mean, you know, I'm no theologian. I'm just a Sunday school teacher, but they've got more money than God, you know? And that means that everybody's always afraid of them, always. Their money didn't help quite as much as you might have thought in this past election. They ran $5 million worth of ads against Bill Nelson in Florida about the Keystone Pipeline, you know, explicitly about it, blasting him for having blocked it, and it didn't move the needle. I think we're, you know, reaching the point when even people who aren't particularly courageous politicians may find they have a tiny bit more room to work, but we've really got to do the work of weakening the fossil fuel industry. That's why this divestment campaign is important. It's not because we're going to be able to bankrupt Exxon overnight because, you know, a bunch of colleges pull out their money. It's because we're going to try and turn them into tobacco, you know. They'll still have some money, but they won't have the kind of political influence that let them stay, let them block any change to the status quo for 20 years.
I want to remind our listeners of Bill McKibben's last book, Earth. I don't know if I've pronounced it right. Yeah, is available through our website, pointofinquiry.org. Okay, so let's talk about making fossil fuel companies like tobacco. And let me be a little, devil's advocate. I mean, are they bad faith actors to the same degree? I mean, you know, the tobacco, everybody knows that image of all the tobacco chiefs before Congress holding up their hands and swearing. I mean, you know, there's some misinformation that's come from fossil fuel companies, but I mean, a lot of them are not even culpable in that, you know, and unlike tobacco, if I could just add, you know, tobacco doesn't provide any necessary service to society, really.
Of course, you could look at it the other way, too. Yeah. I mean, to be damaged by tobacco, you have to partake of it. Be damaged by climate change, you just have to, you know, call this planet home. I think they're pretty damn culpable. I mean, A, they bankrolled for years all kinds of misinformation and lies and whatever.
B, but some of them, not all of them, right?
But they bankrolled, you know, they bankrolled every bad politician you can think of. I mean, they're the big money behind the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the American Petroleum Institute. And these guys have done everything they can think of to keep us from making change. And it's not as if they didn't know. I mean, they sat and watched the Arctic melt. Okay. And what was their response? Was their response to say, we've got a problem here. Let's, you know, start thinking about what we're going to do about it. No, their response was to say, wow, let's go drill in the Arctic for some more of this stuff, you know? So I think you can talk all you want about whether, you know, what exactly their moral culpability is. They're in the way of a solution. And they could be part of that solution if they wanted to. I mean, the day that they decide they want to be energy companies, not fossil fuel companies, they'll play a role. But they're not going to make that decision as long as they're free to make as much money as they're making now. As long as they're free to throw out their waste for free, then they're going to be part of the problem, not part of the solution.
Well, let's say you succeed. And I mean, you know, I agree that just colleges divesting probably won't take away, you know, the wealth of the major, which is, of course, this just gigantic many-trillion-dollar industry. But supposing, and, you write this in Rolling Stone, I mean, a lot of the value of many energy companies is based upon the proven reserves of fossil fuels that they have somewhere in the world that they haven't burned yet. They haven't necessarily dug them up, but they're there, and that's part of the value on the books. And you point out rightly that that if that value was wiped away, they would be worth less. And that's a big enough impact that you would be triggering some kind of economic collapse if that happened, right? I mean,
we'd be triggering an economic transition. And the good news is that we begin to see how that can happen. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, when we talked about renewable energy, we kind of did it, yes, with our fingers crossed a little bit, because it wasn't clear how ready for prime time all this was. But that's no longer the case. I mean, I think in certain ways, the most interesting thing that's happened this year, the good counterpart to the very grim news from places like the Arctic, is the remarkable news coming out of Germany. And there's one big country on Earth that's taken this, one non-Scandinavian country, that's taken all this seriously. It's Germany. And they're making progress. It's not perfect. It's not without troubles. Of course, there are going to be difficulties in this kind of transition. But they're making progress faster than they or anybody else suspected. And the German energy minister in the conservative government of Angela Merkel said, we're going to be at 50% renewables in the 2020s, and we may be at 65%. It's coming faster than we could ever have imagined.
Time. now for something completely different.